Hi, welcome to revisionmedia.org with me, Paul Stevenson. I'm with you here. This is the 5th of September 2019, through with you till 11 p.m. here in the UK where I am. That's 5 till 6 p.m. in the United States. Welcome to the show. And if you're at all, if you've been paying attention at all to politics here in the UK, you'll know, largely like the last 3 years since the vote of the referendum to leave the EU, our political landscape has been dominated by Brexit, or the lack of it, or the frustration of it by the Parliament, which, as I said earlier, we have now a situation where parliamentary democracy is ostensibly an oxymoron. It has been for some time, and it is always, even by the most well-meaning politicians, if you could say such a thing, has been vulnerable to the sort of shenanigans and frustrations that we've seen in the last 3 years. But I mean, we've never seen, it's unprecedented what we've seen in the last 3 years, as the Parliament, which I've said before is largely a fifth column of the globalist internationalists, to stop, thwart, and frustrate Brexit and throw a spanner in the works at every turn. And they're doing it again this week, as Boris Johnson replaces Theresa May and comes in with some new vigor and energy, and, you know, has been running on delivering Brexit, whether we get a deal or not, and has been threatening a no deal, and has prorogued the Parliament, which is normal in one sense, but it has caused uproar and outrage. Isn't it their drug of choice, these liberals and these social justice warriors, and the great hypocrisy and irony is that they're always outraged. It's always an outrage for them. And we're always dictators, anybody who actually wants to carry out democracy, including the Prime Minister, who has a mandate, who ran on his own party's manifesto to leave the EU, and which the lying, mendacious Parliament voted Article 50 to leave the EU, whether we have a deal or not. And it's just been unprecedented, the sort of thwarting and tactics that we've had from the establishment Parliament over the last 3 years. And again, we're seeing it now as they attempt to bring legislation in with a bill to stop a no-deal Brexit at all costs, as I outlined earlier on my previous show. Here's Boris Johnson, and here's the Parliament this week. Order.
The ayes to the right, 328. The noes to the left, 301.
Yeah. Not a good start, Boris. Order. The ayes to the right, 328. The noes to the left, 301. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Unlock.
So a big defeat then for the government. Only the second appearance of Boris Johnson in the House of Commons. Let's listen to him.
By the consequences of this vote tonight, it means that Parliament is on the brink of wrecking any deal that we might be able to strike. Brussels, tomorrow's bill would hand control of the negotiations to the EU. And that would mean more dither, more delay, and more confusion. And even the EU themselves would be able to decide how long to keep this country in the EU. And since I refuse to go along with that plan, we are going to have to make a choice, Mr. Speaker. I don't want an election. The public don't want an election. I don't believe the right honourable gentleman wants an election. But if the House votes for this bill tomorrow, the public will have to choose who goes to Brussels on October the 17th to sort this out and take this country forward. Everybody knows that if the right honourable gentleman is the Prime Minister, he will go to Brussels and beg for an extension. He will accept whatever Brussels demands, and we will have years more arguments over Brexit. And by contrast, Mr. Speaker, everyone knows that if this government is in charge and I go to Brussels, I will go for a deal, and I believe I will get a deal. Even if we don't, you will leave anyway on October the 31st. The people of this country will have to choose, Mr. Speaker. The Leader of the Opposition has been begging for an election for 2 years. He has crowds of supporters outside calling for an election. I don't want an election, but if MPs vote tomorrow to stop negotiations and to compel another pointless delay to Brexit, potentially for years, then that would be the only way to resolve this. And I can confirm that we are tonight tabling a motion under the Fixed Term Parliament Act. Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, on a point of order, I welcome tonight's vote. We live in a parliamentary democracy.
Yeah, they're all up for this parliamentary democracy because they're a bunch of corrupt dictators, essentially, in many cases. They have no respect for democracy, so that's why they love parliamentary democracy rather than the rare occasion we've had of representative, or sorry, of direct democracy, which the referendum was, because they're not interested in that kind of democracy. They're interested in the kind of democracy that they can control, manipulate, and frustrate what the electorate actually voted for. So they love parliamentary democracy. As I said, it's an oxymoron.
We do not have a presidency, but a prime minister. Prime ministers govern with the consent of the House of Commons, representing the people in whom the sovereignty rests.
The problem is you don't represent them very well, do you, Jeremy? And neither do most of your freaking corrupt friends in there.
There is no consent. There is no consent in this house to leave the European Union without...
He should just say there's no... He's going to say without a deal. He should just, like, be honest and say there is no consent in this parliament to leave the European Union, because that's the reality and that's the truth. And we voted to leave the EU, and we didn't say we're going to leave with a deal, and we must not leave without a deal at all costs. So this BS that there's no consent to leave without a deal is just nonsense. People who voted to leave the EU voted to leave the EU. If we get a deal that's satisfactory, unlike Theresa May's deal, which was dubbed the worst deal in history correctly by Nigel Farage, if we get a good deal, which is not that, then great. But we didn't vote for a great deal with the EU when we leave, and if we don't get a great deal, then we must stop a no-deal exit. We voted to leave. And so did these hypocrites in Parliament when they triggered Article 50 and voted to trigger Article 50, which means on the 31st of March, we leave the EU regardless. And that's what Boris Johnson has been saying since he took power, and they're calling him a dictator because he wants to carry out a democratic mandate, one of the biggest democratic mandates in British history, when 17.4 million people voted to leave the EU. They didn't, it wasn't on the ballot box about leaving with a deal or without a deal. And the default position is if we leave, if we do not get a satisfactory deal with the EU, then we leave without a deal and go on WTO terms. Simple as that. So this nonsense that there is no mandate for a no deal exit is total nonsense. It's a total mute point. And they keep talking about it and they keep repeating it because they're just liars, deceivers, and they're playing on the minds of brain-dead, brainwashed, scared people who are misinformed, ignorant, and haughty in many cases because they believe the propaganda about leaving the EU. And so the politicians can get away with churning out this Project Fear time and time again. And it's painful to witness if you're someone who wanted to leave the EU 3 years on, 3 years plus, that we're still haven't left the EU. And after an extension from the 31st of March, again, which was in violation, really, of their voting to trigger Article 50, they're now looking for another extension. What do they think they're going to achieve with another extension? All they're interested in is no deal at all costs. They don't care about anything else. Keep us in the EU or else get the worst deal in history through, or something like that, or get a second referendum, but delay it, and definitely not leave on no deal, because a no deal is actually Brexit. That's the closest thing you'll get to what the people voted for. I didn't vote for a deal, a good deal with the EU. I voted to get out of the EU. We'll work it out after that.
A deal. There is no majority for no deal in the country. As I've said before, if the Prime Minister has the confidence in his...
There's certainly no majority for you, Jezza.
...policy, when he has one he can put forward, he should put it before the people in a public vote. And so...
Oh, they're into a public vote now, you know, because then they can rig that, and they can churn out more Project Fear and have an even more aggressive, mendacious propaganda coming out of their mainstream media, and get people to vote to basically not leave on a no deal, or else remain in the EU, which is, again, is what they really want.
He wants to table a motion for a general election. Fine, get the bill through first in order to take no deal off the table.
As I said, it tells you everything you need to know, that the opposition party will reject the opportunity for a general election in favor of let's get the no deal sorted out first. So that's their priority. And it really, it's staggering that the opposition would turn down the opportunity for a no deal Brexit. It really is, or for a general election. So what does this deal say? The bill says the Prime Minister will have until the 19th of October to either pass a deal in the Parliament or get MPs to approve a no deal Brexit. Once this deadline is passed, he will have to request an extension to the UK's departure date to the 31st of January 2020. I mean, it's just, it'll just go on and on indefinitely, really. But infinitum, I mean, it's just, as I say, what are they going to achieve? And Johnson has pointed this out. It's just dithering and delaying. What are they going to achieve that they haven't had the chance to achieve and haven't achieved in 3 years? Well, they don't know and they don't care. They just know that they want more time to not have a no deal and either get a Labour government or in there, or get a second referendum in there, and or whatever, anything but leave the EU, of course. And unusually, the bill actually includes the wording of the letter he would have to write. If the EU responds by... imagine that. Unusually, the bill actually includes the wording of the letter he would have to write. Talk about control freaks. If the EU responds by proposing a different date, the Prime Minister will have 2 days to accept that proposal. During that time, MPs, not the government, of course, because the government are running on leaving the EU, including with a no deal if necessary, and that's why this is happening. They've wrestled power away from the government. Will have the opportunity to reject the EU's date. The bill also requires ministers to report to the House of Commons over the next few months, potentially providing more opportunities to take control of the timetable. Be aware, though, this could all change over the next few days, because MPs and peers have the power to pass amendments to any law. Meanwhile, the fallout from Number 10's decision to withdraw the party whip from 21 Tory rebels who backed the bill to block no deal has continued to face criticism from others in the party. A group of around 80 Conservatives have written to the Prime Minister calling on him to reinstate the whip to the, quote, principled, hardworking and dedicated MPs, unquote. In a statement on behalf of one of the, quote, One Nation caucus, unquote, former Minister and Tory MP Damien Green said, quote, removing the whip from valued colleagues who have served their country and party with distinction damages our hope of winning the next general election. Well, as I've said, these are unusual times. And Johnson has run on carrying out the mandate of that he has from the British people to leave the EU. Because nothing has... Theresa May, who's been over there colluding with the EU for 3 years, has done nothing. Never wanted to leave the EU, has been doing everything she can to actually make our position worse if we voted for that deal. So Johnson has had more heavy-handed disciplinarian type tactics to try and get to try and get us to actually leave the EU and get this done. But you know, it's just facing incessant criticism at every turn. Now, in an article here in Vox, this is an interesting article. The constitutional changes at the heart of the UK Parliament's endless deadlock. A 2011 law undid the core logic of parliamentary government. Fans of parliamentary government have long touted the notion that the British political system could, at least in theory, never get deadlocked in quite the same way as the American system, in which executive and legislative deadlock has become something of a signature feature. But this week, the story looks very different, as the United Kingdom is currently bogged down in an intractable deadlock between the executive and legislative branches of government over how to approach the looming deadline for Brexit. First, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, was unable to secure a parliamentary majority for her preferred approach to Brexit. That's a very flattering way of putting it, which led to her resignation and replacement by current Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But Johnson can no more secure a majority for his approach than May could, and his determination to try to push forward anyway has generated a week of political crisis. He decided to prorogue, that is, temporarily suspend Parliament for a few weeks in order to shrink the time it had to come up with legislation to thwart his plans. That was part of it. It's also very normal. So despite all this hysteria that it's somehow, you know, totally aberrant in the history of parliamentary democracy, it is not unusual to prorogue. It happens usually happens every year. It actually hasn't happened for two or three years. The period of time that he's proroguing for is a bit longer, admittedly, and it has arguably the effects of lessening the traitors in Parliament to thwart Brexit. But that prompted a member of his Conservative Party to defect to the centrist Liberal Democrats, centrist, costing Johnson his already minuscule parliamentary majority. Then enough Conservative MPs joined with the opposition parties to take control of the parliamentary agenda from Johnson, setting them up to pass a bill that would explicitly constrain him on Brexit. Johnson, in an effort to get the Prime Minister, the MPs in line, wants to hold a fresh election that he thinks will give him a majority of like-minded parliamentarians. And he may well be right if Farage's Brexit Party joined forces with them. I think that would give him easily get him a majority there. But at the moment, it looks like he's not going to get what he wants, and Parliament is going to pass measures over his opposition. It's something that looks much more like an American-style separation of power system than the traditional British fusion of power. The American system has fewer wild swings in policy trajectory, but also makes the total breakdown of the political system that is possible in the US common. It's something that is inconceivable in Latin American countries or under a Westminster-style parliament, at least in theory. The UK's problem today is the consequence of a 2011 law that was passed to address a particular set of circumstances, but has turned out to have much wider-ranging implications for a variety of situations, including introducing the novelty of deadlocks into a system that is not accustomed to them. So the UK famously lacks a written constitution. Britain's eight-word constitution and how it constructs its government explained. So it lacks a written constitution, as I pointed out earlier, unlike, you know, the sort of written and stone kind of institution, a constitution that the US have. But an old quip has it that you can sum up the whole thing with eight words: what the Queen and Parliament enacts is law. Initially, Parliament evolved as an institution that existed to check and balance the power of the monarch. And the American political system operates on a kind of analogy to that 18th century version of British institutions, with the president playing the role of king or a queen, the Senate the role of the House of Lords, and the House of Representatives the role of the House of Commons. Over time, however, the Lords were stripped of almost all their real power, and a new tradition developed in which the Queen would act exclusively on the advice of her Prime Minister. Exactly. So our current Queen never gets involved in politics. If she's approached like she was by Johnson to prorogue, she signs it off.
She has a history right from for her period as queen of never having really, you know, got involved to the point where she would reject any bill that was brought to her for, you know, to get signed off. The Prime Minister, however, is elected by the House of Commons rather than directly by the voters. All power, in other words, are effectively held by the parliamentary majority party. The Queen appoints the leader of the majority party in Parliament as her Prime Minister. The Prime Minister decides which bills Parliament votes on, and then those bills are granted the Queen's royal assent on the advice of the Prime Minister. Members of the majority party are rarely, if ever, unanimous in their views, but as party leader, the Prime Minister can kick them out of the party if they won't do what he wants. Johnson says this will happen to the members of his Conservative Party who defied him, and he did. And more importantly, traditionally, the Prime Minister can dissolve Parliament and call a new election, or formally speaking, advise the Queen to do this. The Prime Minister might lose the election, of course, and thus not get what he or she wants. The Prime Minister also might harbour ambitions that his or her colleagues in Parliament advise are politically untenable, and they may warn the Prime Minister that they won't vote for his or her ideas, and thus that insisting on them will trigger an election campaign he or she will lose. In other words, it's not a dictatorship where the Prime Minister can just do whatever he wants. Mass opinion, the opinion of the members of Parliament, and the interplay between the two play a critical role in shaping outcomes. But you never have a standoff. Either the Prime Minister gets what they want, or there's a new election, which they either win or lose, which is where we're at now, because the Prime Minister hasn't got what he wants. He's had the power wrestled away from him, and he's now wanting a new election, which that's also been Boris Johnson, you know, his call for a general election has also been rejected. I'll cover that in a minute. But Boris Johnson has faced a double defeat in the Commons, the BBC tells us here, after MPs turned down his motion for a general election. Earlier, MPs backed a bill aimed at blocking a no-deal Brexit if the Prime Minister hadn't agreed a plan with the EU ahead of the 31st October deadline. Mr. Johnson said the bill scuppered the negotiations and the only way forward now was an election. So that echoes what this article is telling us about how things work here in the in British politics. So where was I? So in other words, it's not a dictatorship, but you never have a standoff. Either the Prime Minister gets what they want, or there's a new election, which they either win or lose. Implicitly underlying this, however, was the presumption that the UK's election system would deliver something approximating two-party politics with strong majorities. But then everything started to change. The Fixed-Term Parliaments Act and how the 2010 general election changed things. The UK uses a first-past-the-post electoral system just like the United States. This means that whichever candidate in a race gets the most votes wins the seat. As a result, third-party votes are mostly wasted and for a long time created a strong incentive not to do them. But after the 2010 general election, a confluence of global trends and specific circumstances, in particular the Great Recession of 2008 and Prime Minister Tony Blair's support for the Iraq War, led to a surge in votes for both the Liberal Democrats, an economically centrist pro-European party that opposed the war, and a range of small regional parties. No party had a majority in Parliament. Ideologically speaking, the best fit probably would have been a deal between the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats, but there were two problems here. First, the Conservatives won a lot more seats than Labour, so there was a strong sense that the former had, quote, won the election and should get to select the Prime Minister. Second, even in combination, Labour and the Liberal Democrats were a few seats short of a majority, which meant they would have to rely on secondary alliances with the regional parties to form a majority. I know this is probably a little bit long-winded, but I thought it was worthy of going through because it's, you know, the thing is, our Parliament, the Parliament and our politicians rely so much on a populace and an electorate which is ignorant and is too busy and too interested in watching trash TV and all sorts of other nonsense while they know what's going on, and therefore they're in a position to pass bills and manipulate parliamentary democracy
to further their own nefarious agendas. And I think this has value. So people, you know, and I think all this is Brexit stuff. Has, if nothing else comes out of it, it has, you know, woken people up to the facade of democracy, but also it's got people interested in what's actually happening in our political system. So I thought this article was worthy of reading, and I think it's edifying. So, second, and even in combination, Labour and the Liberal Democrats were a few seats short of a majority, which meant they would have had to rely on secondary alliances with the regional parties to form a majority. So instead, the Liberal Democrats opted to work with David Cameron's Conservative Party and form a coalition cabinet. This is highly unusual in UK politics. But they opted for this course rather than letting Cameron form a minority government, supposedly due to the need for stability in a time of economic crisis. To further that goal of stability, the coalition government then passed the Fixed-Term Parliaments Act of 2011, which denied the Prime Minister the authority to unilaterally call a new election. Under the new system, a parliament would last a full five-year term unless a two-thirds supermajority voted for dissolution in earlier elections. This law served a specific purpose and ensured that the coalition lasted its whole five-year term. But it's now carried forward into a totally different situation and produced an unprecedented ability for the executive and legislative branches to systematically disagree. And that's what you're seeing now and witnessing in Parliament, and have been for some time over the Brexit debacle. So pertaining to Brexit and the gridlock, the current impasses began with Theresa May's efforts to get Parliament to approve the Brexit agreement she negotiated with the European Union at the beginning of the year. Unfortunately, while no one in Parliament could seem to agree on what kind of deal they wanted, they all, including members of her own party, agreed that they didn't like the deal May had on offer. The Conservatives contains a large faction that either actively favours a total rupturing of UK-EU ties, as they term a hard Brexit, or as I call just Brexit, which is what we voted for, or at least believes that a willingness to accept a chaotic no-deal scenario will improve the UK's bargaining hand and create a more satisfactory deal. Common sense. That meant that compromise measures designed to guarantee that there wouldn't need to be a traditional border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, would be leaving the EU, and the Republic of Ireland, which is still in the EU, couldn't pass Parliament with purely Conservative votes. But rather than prop up May's compromise efforts, opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn took the position that the real problem was May and her negotiating position. He wanted a fresh election that he hoped to win, thus enabling him to pursue his own approach to Brexit. What exactly that approach would be has been a matter of some dispute. Key to this strategy was the belief that Labour was likely to do well in a new election, primarily because of the rise of a new Brexit party that espoused a harder line than May. Labour believed that vote splitting between the Conservatives and the Brexit Party could bring them to power either alone or in partnership with some other parties. With both Conservatives and members of the opposition blocking her every move, May faced a complete deadlock that eventually led to her resignation. Enter Boris Johnson. Johnson has promised to pull the UK out of the EU by the October the 31st deadline, do or die, meaning with or without a deal with the EU in place. He also argues that the threat of a disruptive, quote, no-deal Brexit, unquote, will intimidate the EU into offering the UK better terms. Again, it's common sense. I mean, you need to have some bargaining chips, and if you can't walk away from a deal, then you're not in a very strong position, really, because they've got you by the balls, really, quite frankly. Johnson is almost certainly wrong about this article says, and people familiar with Brussels says he's fundamentally misunderstanding how the European Union works. A critical faction of rebel Conservative MPs disagree with this strategy and sided with the opposition to block his plans. So now Johnson wants new elections that he believes will win because, having co-opted the hardline position on Brexit, he will secure a unified vote of Brexit supporters, while the sceptics will be divided across several parties. Under the classic UK political system, this is exactly what would happen. Johnson will call a new election, and either the rogue Conservative MPs will be replaced by more reliable members, thus enabling Johnson to carry out his agenda unimpeded, or he'd lose big time and someone else would become Prime Minister and get to try their hand at managing Brexit. But under the fixed term system, this doesn't work. A new election can be called only if the governing party and the opposition both agree to do one. Which brings us up to where we're at now, where they've already, you know, where Johnson has called for a general election, but Labour have said, no, we're not having an election until after it's been signed off by the Queen as written in stone that we're, you know, we don't leave on a no deal on the 31st of October, and we won't, he's not agreeing to a general election at this stage until after the 31st of October. And they've got an extension and no deal has been signed off. But the government will put forward a new motion on Monday for general election, says Jacob Rees-Mogg. We can get to that article in a minute. And again, I know this is long-winded, but it's just to give an idea as to, you know, about the underpinnings and the foundations of British of parliamentary democracy in this country. So Johnson could call a new election and either the rogue Conservative MPs will be replaced by a more reliable one. Under the fixed term system, this doesn't work. A new election can be called only if the governing party and the opposition both agree to do one. And for that to happen, basically one party or the other has to miscalculate about who's going to win. And right now, though, Johnson and Corbyn both agree that a fast election would likely help Johnson. So it seems unlikely to happen. The result is a situation that becomes very familiar to Americans, a mix of gridlock and constitutional hardball in which party leaders seek to exploit various technicalities or little-used powers to gain advantage, and the actual policy outcomes don't represent any party leader's stated preference. Since the main purpose of the Fixed Terms Parliament Act was to secure the stability of one particular coalition government, the law perhaps should have been written to automatically expire after 5 years. Hear, hear. And I don't know. I mean, can, unless you can get, I don't know whether, I don't think Johnson can change that now as Prime Minister. But I agree. I think that should have been because of, you know, the reason it was brought in was to secure the stability of one particular coalition government, which is, you know, was a rarity. It should have been written to automatically expire after 5 years. And when we wouldn't be in this situation, Johnson would be in the driving seat. Had that happened, the underlying argument shaping Brexit would be exactly the same, but the ongoing entrenched political crisis would have been impossible. It's an interesting article. Again, it's a bit long-winded, but, you know, as I say, I think it's important because so much of the shenanigans and the corruption that goes on within parliamentary democracy is facilitated by the ignorance of the electorate and the population at large, who just haven't a clue or they're not interested in what happens in politics and the day-to-day mechanics of the parliament and politics in the country. So it's good to learn that stuff, you know. Right. Jacob Rees-Mogg has said that the government will put forward a new motion on Monday for an early general election because, as I pointed out in the previous article, that Johnson has faced a double defeat in the Commons after MPs turned down his motion for a general election. As that previous article outlined, that would not be allowed to be the case except for the fixed term Parliament Act that I just outlined, which has his hands tied and allows the opposition to scupper having, you know, complete say on when they have a general election. And that's unfortunate. It is unfortunate if you're someone who wants to leave the EU. Johnson wants to hold the election on the October 15th, but failed on Wednesday to get the Commons two-thirds majority required to trigger a snap election. Labour has said it would not support an early election until legislation which aims to block a no-deal exit at the end of October has become law. Echoes just what I've been just saying. The European Union bill went through the Commons on Wednesday, but needs to also pass the House of Lords, which it did, before Parliament is prorogued next week. Announcing business for next week, Mr. Rees-Mogg, the leader of the House of Commons, said there would be time to consider any amendments from the Lords connected to legislation, such as measures designed to prevent a no-deal Brexit on the 31st of October, adding, quote, there will be a motion relating to an early parliamentary general election. The House will not adjourn until royal assent has been received to all acts.
a message may be received from the Lord as Commissioner, and I will return to the House on Monday with further information if necessary. Conservative former Minister Sir Edward Lee asked if the European Union withdrawal bill will receive royal assent on Monday, adding, quote, "The reason why I ask this is because I distinctly heard the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn say yesterday that once the bill became law, he would vote for an early general election. Would Mr. Rees-Mogg agree with me that it would be quite extraordinary if after this long session of Parliament, which is clearly deadlocked, every member of Parliament, at least two-thirds, didn't vote for an immediate general election to put this to the people?" With Rees-Mogg replying, quote, "It is indeed an addled Parliament and is not able to get things done, and the conclusion you draw is correct." And again, just echoing the previous article about how, you know, British politics find itself in this situation as a result of this Fixed Term Parliament Act, which is really designed to facilitate a coalition government. And as the article rightly points out, a good solution to it would have been that it automatically expires after 5 years. But alas, here we are giving more ammunition to the Ramoners in Parliament to stop Brexit. And to me, a no-deal Brexit is still, it's just Brexit. They're making a big deal that no-deal Brexit is. There's no consent for a no-deal Brexit. Well, there is. It's called the referendum result, and it's called Article 50, which the large majority of those in Parliament voted for. So, yes, there is. He said royal assent will be given speedily once the bill has completed its passage through Parliament. Rees-Mogg later failed to rule out the government making a third attempt to trigger a general election should the second bid fail on Monday. As I say, fair play to him. Quite often, persistence is omnipotent. Labour former Minister Angela Eagle said, quote, "The Leader of the House has been extremely coy about when prorogation will actually happen. He hasn't announced it will be Tuesday or Thursday. Who cares what you say?" Rees-Mogg replied, "The Privy Council determined that a commission should be established under the Lord High Chancellor and under the Great Seal should be able to prorogue Parliament on Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday next week. Parliament will be prorogued according to decision made by that commission." That commission has not made it yet. It's made its decision. And if you're not familiar with Jacob Rees-Mogg, he really is a throwback to... he's kind of affectionately known as the MP for, before he had this position in government, as the MP for the 18th century or something, because he really is like a throwback to the Victorian era. He dresses in a double-breasted suit and he speaks so well, and it's really kind of like really traditional. He literally is like, you know, throwback to, you know, what was great about Britain and when it actually had an identity, rather than if you fly in here today, you may as well fly into somewhere, anywhere in the third world. I mean, you could be flying into Mosul when you fly into Heathrow. But he really is a throwback, and you know, and he's got such an eloquent and I think a beautiful command of the English language from his education, and great temperament as well. And he's reassuring, and I'm glad he's on our side. He's a principled man. He's a religious man, and he hasn't backed down either on his religious principles when he's been grilled, of course, by the Christian hating media. So. And as I say, you know, he's reassuring, and I've broken lots about Jacob Rees-Mogg down in my other radio show on Revolution Radio. So I'll play a clip of him before I do. Just to give you the United States audience here, which largely it is, an idea of what I'm talking about when I talk about his eloquent and command of the English language, and sort of, he literally does look and sound like someone from a throwback to the Victorian Britain. I will say, do support revisionmedia.org because we're 100% listener supported. Any donations to the network are appreciated. If you want to call in, you can do that. Let me just see if there. I've got the number here again, because I'm. I think this is only my third show as well on the network, so I need to get those numbers down. But anyway, I'll get them up. They're on the revisionmedia.org website. Anyway, If you want to support the work I do, you can do that at Stevenson_P5@sky.com and PayPal. And I'll just play a little clip here from Jacob Rees-Mogg talking about the debacle of Brexit this week and the struggles that's been going on in the last few days, and mentioning, if he gets to it, the intention to put a bill forward for, or not a bill, but to call for a general election again on Monday.
Order. Business statement. The Leader of the House, Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I begin by apologising to the Shadow Leader and to the Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Perth and North Perthshire, that this statement is later than it normally is to ensure as full information as possible for the House. I understand this has caused some travel arrangement difficulties, and that is a matter of regret. The business for the week commencing the 9th of September will include Monday, 9th of September, if necessary, consideration of Lords' amendments, followed by debate to approve a motion relating to Section 7 of the Northern Ireland Executive Formation Act 2019, historical institutional abuse, followed by a similar debate for victims' payments, followed by, under the same Act, a debate on human trafficking, followed by a further motion under the same Act on gambling, followed by a general debate on a motion relating to Section 3.2 of the Northern Ireland Executive Formation, etc. Act 2019, followed by, if necessary, consideration of Lords' amendments, followed by a motion relating to an early parliamentary general election. The House will not adjourn until Royal Assent has been received to all Acts. A message may be received from the Lords Commissioner, and I will return to the House on Monday with further information if necessary.
Valerie Vaz.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I thank the Leader of the House? I was going to say it's the usual custom and convention to thank him, but I appreciate that he's apologised. At least I abide by custom and conventions. And I do want to thank the Leader, actually, for being vertical when he gave that business statement. Mr. Speaker, I just have a couple of...
This is, of course, the vertical when he made the statement. This is, of course, this outrage in the media and the condemnation that Jacob Rees-Mogg has received in the mainstream media, because he likes to slouch occasionally in the House of Commons, probably out of boredom and frustration at listening to the likes of the current speaker here. But it was so over the top. It was incredible. You know, because he does it quite regularly, but you know, they made a really massive deal of this because he's basically wants to leave the EU. That's why.
Questions on that on the Northern Ireland legislation, the opposition will cooperate with the government to make sure that that legislation gets through, and obviously we are keen to see the Lords' amendments, if there are any, come back to the House to be debated on the European Union withdrawal. Bill number 6. I wonder if I could ask the Leader of the House, when he was in his response, to say exactly what the motion is relating to the early parliamentary election, if it is a similar one under the Fixed Term Parliament Act, and when he's likely to table that motion. I raised the case previously of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, as I said I would do every week. Could he update the House on her case as things have taken a different turn? And also those of the other UK nationals who are in prison, Kamal Farooqi, who was detained in May 2011, Anousheh Ashouri, who was detained in August 2017, and British Council employee Aras Amiri, who was detained in March 2018 and has now been given a 10-year sentence for visiting her grandmother. I have to say that I asked the previous Leader of the House about the Queen's speech, and I know that's been thrown back at me a number of times, because we have had the longest continuous parliamentary session since the Acts of Union 1800, Mr. Speaker. There was hardly any business legislated while the government at that time was going through a leadership election. The government chose to have a long session, and no legislation was progressing, despite me asking for that at opposition days, which I haven't been given. And we should have realised something was going to happen when question was asked about when would the trade bill come back, and I think the leader responded in these terms. He said, why would we want to do that? That should have given us a clue. Now, we've got a number of bills that are coming that are stuck, the immigration bill, the agricultural bill, the fisheries bill, the financial services bill. Now, we know they fall when Parliament is prorogued, but not statutory instruments. They're still alive. So could the leader of the House say what he plans to do, what the government plans to do with those bills? I asked the previous leader of the House, the Honourable Member for Devon Central, whether he would whether we could sit during the conference recess, and we on this side were ready to do that. Mr. Speaker, there is nothing conventional about the government's plans for prorogation. Whilst most prorogations last a few days and take place just before the Queen's speech, this is 5 weeks. It will be the longest in more than 40 years. But I want to ask the Leader of the House if he could clarify what he said yesterday during the debate. He didn't answer when asked whether he knew that the House was going to be prorogued on the 16th of August. In fact, he said he was at Lord's. So I will ask it again. Did he know on the 16th of August, when he was at Lord's, whether the House was going to be prorogued, whether he had seen that email? 2 weeks later, he was on a plane to Aberdeen Airport. When was he told he was going to Balmoral? And when did he know what was in the proclamation? Mr. Speaker, the reason why we don't trust this government, and they take their lead from the Prime Minister, because he says one thing and does something else. He wrote in a letter to all his colleagues when he wanted to be the Prime Minister. He said, I'm not attracted to arcane procedures such as the prorogation of Parliament. And I'm a One Nation Conservative, and yet he has prorogued Parliament, and he has withdrawn the whip, possibly sacked, possibly expelled, some of the most honourable and right honourable members who have given great service to their party and to their country. And now we face the fact that the right honourable member for Orpington has resigned and no longer wants to stand. The Prime Minister's own brother can't take it anymore. And that's why we don't trust the government and the Prime Minister. He secretly agreed to suspend Parliament 2 weeks before denying it would happen. He is treating Parliament, democracy and the people with contempt. 22 law professors have written an open letter and said the prorogation is clearly designed to evade scrutiny, including legislation, and preventing MPs from asking key questions on EU negotiations and no-deal planning. So, what were the reasons for the prorogation at that time, without recourse to coming to the chamber and explaining it? Mr. Speaker, an important bill was passed yesterday, and it's making its way through the Lords. It stops a no-deal. And here are the reasons why that is an important bill. The director of the CBI has said no-deal is a tripwire into economic chaos that would harm our country for years to
come. Okay, this is Project Fear, and it's, you know, this is the establishment, the CBI right up there. The CBI, the best thing the CBI has going for it is its consistency. It's consistently wrong. Every time it predicts something, it turns out to be totally wrong. But yet, they rely on people being ignorant and having a short memory. So we can disregard the bullshit that comes out of the CBI. Continue.
Come. Is that scaremongering? The General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress said no deal would be a disaster for working.
All of these types of bodies like the CBI, the BMA, the British Medical Association, all of them, the Remainstream media, they're all invested in anti-nationalist, pro-globalist type philosophy. So, of course, they're going to churn out this mendacious propaganda about the, you know, as I say, it's a sort of language that ought to be reserved for prophetic doomsday eschatology. But alas, they have the pathological audacity to churn this stuff out, with the greatest tragedy being that huge swathes of our own population swallow this BS.
Is that scaremongering? The president of the National Farmers Union said.
Oh, yeah, there's another one. Professor of the Farmers Union. Yeah, there's another one.
Out of business. Food and Drink Federation has warned it would inflict serious and in some cases mortal damage on the UK food and drink industry.
Mortal damage on the UK food and drink industry. Do you ever hear as much BS in all your life? You know, I think my main motivation now of getting out of the EU is that we can just play these clips over and over again for years to come about just how
disingenuous, deceptive, and or incompetent at best that these politicians who have been espousing this BS for years, or since we were supposed to leave the EU. It's just incessant propaganda, and I would love the opportunity to throw this crap back in their faces if we can leave without a no deal.
Is that scaremongering? The British Medical Association has said in their report, dangers of a no deal.
That's what I said, the BMA as well, the British Medical Association, who poison the people with antidepressants, who take backhanders from Big Pharma and try and kill you with vaccines. Yeah, they're really people to be respecting, aren't they, and listening to. But anyway, go ahead.
Could lead to the disintegration of the NHS. The fashion industry worth...
Oh, give it a rest.
...said no deal should be avoided. The Incorporated Society of Musicians said no deal Brexit will incur major disruption to the music industry worth...
Who gives a shit?
Are they scaremongering?
No, Ian not at all. Hofstadt, oh, no, they're not.
Coordinator for EU Brexit said, the only people who will prosper are the wealthy bankers and hedge fund managers who have bet on chaos. I think the Leader of the House also owes an apology to Dr. David Nicholl. He was part of Operation Yellowhammer. When will the Leader of the House publish Operation Yellowhammer? Or does he think the government are scaremongering? Mr. Speaker, they're like the wolves of Whitehall. They're marauding over our customs and our conventions. It's absolutely outrageous the way they are destroying. And actually, the Prime Minister only governs by custom and convention. I think the Leader of the House also owes an apology to Mr. Speaker. I think he was heard on air to say that Mr. Speaker was wrong. But I want to remind him...
Mr. Speaker, the Jewish... You know, Mr. Speaker Berko, doesn't he? Who's so arrogant and so bold, doesn't even attempt to be impartial, which defines the Speaker of the House. But anyway, go ahead.
Of his bedtime reading, Erskine May, of the dedication that is compiled by some of the officials, both past and present. And it says this, Speaker of the Commons and in the Lords and all the Commonwealth speakers, on whom fall the great responsibilities of guardianship of the parliamentary system. We saw that this week, and we thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Let me deal with the last point first, because I would not have dreamt of saying that you were wrong. I made the point, a classic point, that you have not eyes to see with nor lips to speak except as directed by this House. And I believe, Mr. Speaker, that that is what you do properly, and you have consistently taken the view that the House should be able to debate what it wishes to debate. Though I will confess that sometimes, if I were in your position, I might come to a different decision. That is not in any sense disrespectful to Mr. Speaker. But let me come to this panoply of questions that we've had. First of all, I thank the Honourable Lady for supporting us on Northern Ireland legislation and looking forward to the Lord's amendments. The early parliamentary motion will be put down tonight, as it needs to be before the close of business. And the very important issue that the Honourable Lady raises every occasion on Nazanin and Zaghari Ratcliffe, the Foreign Office is doing what it can. It is a very difficult situation. It is so important that the Foreign Office, in all these consular cases, and the Honourable Lady mentioned a number of them, is as vigorous as it can be. In my view, the statement of Prime Minister Lord Palmerston in the Don Pacifico affair is the right approach for governments to take in defending the interests of British citizens abroad. We should be incredibly robust about it, and I believe the Foreign Office is doing as much as it possibly can, but sadly we cannot tell other countries what to do. We then come on to the Queen's speech, what's going to happen with the bills that are stuck. The bills that are stuck will come unstuck because they will fall on sort of dice that we're able to use. And I'm glad to tell the House that all the bills that are needed for leaving the European Union on the 31st of October are in place. And then we come into the diary questions. What was I doing the ability to leave on the 31st of October, all the legislation that is needed is statutory instruments to make sure it will all happen smoothly. So that is all done, it is ready, it is prepared. Her Majesty's government has been a model of efficiency and efficacy in preparing this, and my right honourable friend, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, is perhaps one of the most impressive administrative ministers this country has ever seen.
Okay, I will leave it there, and I'll be back with you next Thursday. That's Thursday the 12th, same time, 12th of September at 10 p.m. till 11 p.m. in the UK. That's 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank you for joining me here on revisionmedia.org. I'm Paul Stevenson, and until next week, have a great week, and God bless you.